used to work here at PI, so it's really nice to be back. Thank you for facilitating that. Thank you for coming if you like soccer or for not liking soccer enough to come. It's good to have some audience. Today I'm going to talk about, after dithering over the title for a bit, analytical techniques for finding optimal measurements. Really what I'm interested in is, quite often you might have information encoded across many systems, for example. And the best measurement to do is some kind of joint measurement across all those systems. When is it better enough, sufficiently better, that it merits this extra sort of experimental difficulty? So the kind of theme is, when are sort of quite simple experimental strategies good enough that you don't need to go to the additional experimental difficulty? And along the way of trying to answer this question, we came up with a couple of new techniques for analytical techniques for looking at state discrimination problems. I'll give a couple of examples of those. The early work that I'm going to talk about as the sort of motivation for this dates back to when I was here at PI. So I thought it was a nice thing to start with, and that was work with Robin. The main subject of the talk is work with my student, Graham, who's just graduated, and my colleague, Steve, at Glasgow. I always like when people speak if they tell me why I should be interested in what they're speaking about. So this may not be why you would be interested in this, but I'll start at least with the motivation of why I started to look at these sorts of problems. And that comes from this work that I mentioned that I did back when I was here at PI. I'll give some simple examples of some measurement tasks for which a quantum probe, which can somehow learn about quantum information, it doesn't help very much. And then the remainder of the talk is based on this motivation. So if these examples are such that a quantum probe doesn't help very much, are there some quite simple examples for which a small quantum probe would help? And so I'll introduce a couple of analytical techniques and give some examples for each of those cases. Okay, so this is my motivation for why I started looking at these sorts of problems. Back when I was a postdoc here, we were interested in how can you think about a small quantum system as learning about external quantum systems. So I don't want to necessarily do classical measurements with some classical readout on my quantum systems, but I want to think about a quantum system as gathering information about other systems. What would that mean? And so this is the sort of general paradigm, is I have some small quantum system which I would like to gather information about other systems. And so it can interact sequentially with other systems of interest. And so I think of these as being sample systems which have some information encoded in them. And this processor can interact sequentially with each one and extract information in some sense, which I'll try to make a bit more concrete soon. So it interacts with each system once and then moves on and interacts with the next one and never goes back to something that it's already looked at. And the assumptions for this paradigm were that you have universal control over the processor with readout at some point. So maybe at the end you would read out. And as I said, this idea is that the processor gains somehow quantum information about the systems through interaction. Throughout the protocol, this information is stored in this processor, and at the very end, we can read out in the usual way. But we want to put off classical measurements or measurements with classical readout as long as possible. I should say, it used to be tradition here at PI that you could stop a speaker at any time. I don't know if it still is, but do feel free to interrupt with questions. Yeah.
So I suppose it doesn't need to be separate systems. It could be S1, S2. They could be the same system at different times.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And so you might think of, for example, a sensing protocol whereby you have an electron interact with an environment and it processes in the spin. You extract that information, reinitialize, and let it interact again, for example. Yeah.
Sure.
And on that note, so one thing I was going to draw attention to is the similarity to these collision models, which have that kind of flavor. So collision models is something that people look at in open quantum systems, where you model your environment as a set of subsystems that your system is interacting with. And you can model various kinds of behavior with memory if you let the system interact again with different, with the same subsystem. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. So yeah, just to note a similarity to, there's various schemes that act in this kind of way. One is ancilla-driven computation. So you can imagine that you're using this ancilla to drive the evolution of the register. The other is this collision model that I noted. What we were interested in is really a learning. Can I extract as much information as possible from this register? What does that mean in practice? So a simple example, suppose I just have two possible states. And each of these systems of interest is prepared in either the yellow state or the red state. I would like to interact my probe with each of them to somehow extract the global information of yellow versus red.
Each is either yellow or red. You mean they are all yellow or they're all
yes,
red?
Yes, yes, yeah. So there's just two possible global states. They're all in the same state. Yeah. And those states I can parameterize by some parameter theta. And so just to make the point that this isn't the same, this notion of learning is not the same as doing a sort of controlled operation, the best thing to do on the first copy, if I really want to extract everything, is just to swap. Okay, so my first move in this protocol is just to swap everything that was in here into the processor. And so what's left is nothing in the sample and everything in the processor. As I move on, I now move on and interact with the next system. And although I've got a four-dimensional space here, if these are qubits, there's only two dimensions that are interesting. And they're the dimensions spanned by two yellow and spanned by two red. And because I know there's only two dimensions that are interesting, I can fit them in the processor. If you want to look at the mathematics a little bit, so two copies of this state, of these states look like this with either a plus or a minus sign here. And I can pick out a subspace spanned by this state and this state, and I can define a unitary which basically rolls that, all of that into the processor. And the result of that is the processor states after doing this unitary become a little bit more distinguishable, a little bit more orthogonal, and there's nothing left in the sample. And you can imagine that you keep doing this with the other samples. So each time I interact my processor with a sample, the processor states become a little bit more orthogonal, and I pull everything out of the sample, and something else has happened in the match, and so on. Okay, so with that, you can define a notion of this system kind of learning about the quantum information that was stored in this state. At some point at the end, I might want to read it out and do a measurement on this system. But in the meantime, I don't collapse anything, so I'm not losing anything at all. So why more general things? You can generalize this to more general input states. This is the simplest case with just two states. You can talk about entangled states. You can talk about completely unknown states and so on. The sort of conceptual advantage or appeal of it was that, first of all, this provides an explicit way of doing joint measurements by interacting with this probe. Further, the size of the probe must be somehow at least as big as the subspace containing the quantum information. And so somehow it quantifies the resources needed to do this joint measurement. And the main thing that both Robin and I think liked about it at the time was that it restores a symmetry somehow that was broken between classical and quantum data gathering. So what do I mean by that? If you want to distinguish between two classical distributions, it's completely enough to draw samples and look at them separately and then do some post-processing, so store a sufficient statistic. In quantum mechanics, this is not the case. So you need to do some kind of joint measurement across the samples. But if we redefine measurement to be this interaction with a probe, then in fact, you can think of it as in the same way. Yeah.
So I missed it. If you are you saying that if you allowed a global measurement on all six systems, then you could do better than this sequential?
So, in fact, you're right. In this case, you can't, and I'll come back to that. But in general, I'm sorry. If you allow global measurement, can you do better than this scheme? No. So with this scheme, you can do the optimal global measurement, almost by definition, because everything is unitary. So you don't lose any quantum information at any point.
And the assumption there was that you knew the red and the yellow state.
Yes.
And you knew it was one or the other.
Yeah, exactly. So
you know which unitaries to apply.
So this is quite carefully tailored to exactly what these states are. That's right. Yeah. It doesn't work in general. But you can still talk about a notion of learning if these are completely unknown. And then you need a larger processor.
So then there are some tests for which global measurements are needed. Or are you saying it appeared that way and this shows that in fact you don't need global measurements?
Okay. So what I'm saying is that this gives me a way to implement any global measurement. And this thing about the symmetry between classical versus quantum data gathering is if I define my notion of measurement to be an interaction with a quantum system rather than an interaction with a classical click, then I can do all the processing by sequential interactions with a single measuring device, just as in the classical case. Okay. Okay, so that's all this sort of preamble. The conceptual advantages, okay, there's some conceptual appeal perhaps, but are there some practical advantages to this kind of scheme? And in particular, are there simple examples of just a couple of small systems for which this might give us some advantage and therefore might be worth demonstrating experimentally? Well, this case that I told you, it's quite a nice simple case to illustrate the idea. But actually, we know you can do this by just local measurement and feed forward. And so for just these two pure states, we can always perform the optimal measurement by doing something much simpler. And so there's no need for this extra difficulty of having a quantum probe. And actually, more generally, for any two, so suppose my sample systems are not prepared in the same system, in the same state, but there are only two possible states. They may be entangled across all systems. It's known that a local adaptive measurement is enough to discriminate two orthogonal entangled
systems. What does those words mean? Adaptive, local adaptive measurement.
Okay, so local adaptive, I mean I make a measurement on the first sample, and then based on the result of measurement on that system, I choose a measurement on the second. Yeah, thanks. And that'll be important later. Okay, so in fact, if I have only two states, I can do all this by local adaptive measurement. So again, there's no need to have this quantum probe. And indeed, you can show something a little bit more general than this, which is if the information is encoded in a two-dimensional subspace, actually you can do any POVM measurement. And so the punchline is that a single qubit probe in this kind of scheme is never going to give us anything that we can't do by a much simpler scheme. Doesn't help at all. Okay, so if the goal is to find something for which this might be useful, so some sort of simple example, we need to define what we should compare it with. So this gives a way to perform joint measurements. What are the sorts of problems for which I can claim this kind of joint measurement gives me an advantage over what I can do with local measurements? Well, I need to define what I mean by local measurements, which come back to this question of local adaptive. So what kinds of things are easy to do in the lab? So if I want to say that I can't do joint measurements, what else should I sort of not allow? And what I'm going to take as being the things that are hard to do are joint measurements, so I don't have entanglement. And quantum memories are in development, but maybe not that good yet. And so I'm going to not allow quantum memories or joint measurements. Yeah.
I don't know what quantum memory means. I'm sorry. What's a quantum memory?
So I just mean the ability to store quantum states. And the reason I impose this is you can imagine measurement schemes where I have, for example, two systems, and I allow lots of rounds of classical communication. So I measure this system weekly. Based on the output, I choose a measurement on the other system. I measure that weekly, and so on. And that's both hard to characterize and actually reasonably powerful.
The ancilla is not considered a quantum memory?
The ancilla is. So now I'm talking about what should I compare it with. Yeah, absolutely. So when is it worth doing something more complicated that requires a quantum memory and or joint measurement? So when can I do something that I can't do without those? So so in this initial scheme, I can perform any joint measurement over many systems, just depending on how big this probe system could be. To motivate that, I should talk about what I can do without a quantum memory and without joint measurement. And so the sort of class of measurements to compare it with is this one-way LOCC or this local adaptive measurements. Okay, so the next sort of simplest example for this kind of scheme is two copies of the trine state. So this is quite a famous example. The trine states are qubit states with symmetry. So think of them as spin states separated by 120 degrees from one another. if I have two copies of these, it's known, it's a very famous example, that you can't do the optimal measurement to distinguish which of these three states your two systems was prepared in through local measurements. And this was one of the first examples of this. But indeed, if you restrict through local measurement and feed forward, the gap is still pretty small. So if I know I have two systems prepared in one of these three states, and I can do a joint measurement on the two systems, the probability of success is 97%. If all I can do is local measurement and feed forward, I can get 93%, which is actually not bad. Yeah.
Is this word feed forward the same as
Apologies, yes.
You were calling before?
Yeah, exactly. So feed forward of classical information or adaptive, yeah. So, you know, you could see such a gap experimentally, but is it big enough to sort of motivate this additional experimental difficulty? And it's actually relatively small. Okay, so before I introduce a couple of the techniques that we use, let me just say something general about minimum error state discrimination to tackle these sorts of problems, so to find measurement problems for which there is a gap. So in minimum error state discrimination, the idea is your system or systems are prepared in one of a number of known possible states with known prior probabilities. So your state is drawn from some set rho I with probabilities pi. Any measurement I can do on them is described by some P of M. And the probability of correctly determining the state is just the sum over the possibilities of the priors times the probability that I indeed get the outcome J if state J was prepared. Now, what's known and what's been known since the 70s is that the measurement minimizing the error satisfies these conditions. So these are operator inequalities.
It's an operator inequality, but is it like, is your this product of operators Hermitian?
It's not obvious, is it? So for an arbitrary POVM measurement, this is not a Hermitian operator. Yeah, you're right. But for the optimal one, it will be. Yeah, good question. So these conditions, this is necessary and sufficient. The conditions are not independent. You can derive the second one from the first. So this is the sort of important one. But in practice, this one is sometimes easier to check. And just to give some intuition for what they mean, you can think of them as a little bit like a first derivative condition and a second derivative condition. So this is like a stationary point, and this is telling you whether it's a maximum or a minimum, sort of. So it's useful to have these conditions if you have a set of states and you want to find what's the best measurement I can make for some kind of communication scheme or something. If you have a candidate measurement, you can plug it in and figure out whether it's the best one or not. But they're not constructive. So if you don't have a candidate measurement, this doesn't tell you how to choose one. Yeah?
Could you use that as like a loss function for an error, or does it only work at the
So you can generalize it to more general sort of Bayes risk strategies, if that's what you mean. Yeah. And the other thing I would note about them is this does define a semi-definite program, so you can solve these things efficiently numerically. I would argue that sometimes you get a bit more insight by having analytical solutions, and I'll come back to that later. Anything else? Okay, so just to give a little bit more insight, this is the important condition, and I'll just show why it's necessary but not sufficient, because that's a bit harder. So the condition itself is necessary and sufficient. Just a sketch of that proof. If this is an optimal measurement, then by definition, this quantity should be bigger than that for any other possible POVM measurement. Then if I use the fact that these sums of the identity and just insert in here, I can rearrange everything in this way. And it should be clear that if this is a positive operator, this inequality is satisfied. Okay. So the trace of the product of two positive operators is positive, and the sum over those is positive. So it's a sufficient condition that this is a positive operator. So just to give you an idea of kind of where it comes from. The proof of necessity is a little bit more involved, but you can do it via a variation of the measurement. Just to give you a flavor of that. Okay, so suppose now I would like to know what's the best sequential measurement for a given measurement problem. Okay, so I have a set of states over perhaps two systems. In fact, we'll talk about just the bipartite state, bipartite case. So across two systems, and what's the best local adaptive strategy in order to measure these two systems? So what's the kind of strategies that I'm considering? On system A, I can make some measurement, whatever measurement I like. And then on system B, I choose a measurement based on the result of measurement of system A. So if I get outcome 0, I measure this measurement on system B, and so on. And so the structure of the POVM measurements over the two systems that I'm considering is like this. And so the first kind of additional analytical technique I wanted to introduce is an analog of those Hellstrom conditions for local adaptive measurements. And it looks like this. So don't worry too much about the form of it. I'll just talk you through kind of the important points. If I want to optimize this quantity, so a joint state over a set of joint states over systems A and B with this kind of measurement that I introduced in the previous slide. you can straight away pull out some necessary conditions for this to be an optimal adaptive procedure. And these just come from, for example, this first one comes from saying, well, once I've made the measurement on the first system, I can update my priors about the states. And whatever I do on the next system, it should be optimal for the states given the updated priors. And so that's where this first one comes from. And the second one has a kind of a similar flavor, but in the reverse direction. So these are both necessary. So there's something that you can check if you've got a candidate measurement which may be optimal to rule out, but they're not sufficient. This is a condition which is both necessary and sufficient. And the only thing I'll point out about it is it still contains an arbitrary measurement on the second system. Okay, so this is, again, an operator inequality. This is a trace over B only. So this is an operator on A, and this is an operator on A. So don't worry too much about the form of them, but it's sort of similar in flavor to the Hellstrom conditions that I introduced previously. But now we have an equivalent condition that we can use for local adaptive measurements. Okay, so what do we now know, given those conditions? So there's a very famous example of the domino states, which are a set of, they form a basis for a two Q-trit system, so they're a set of orthogonal states. So they can be perfectly distinguished if you can do a global measurement over the two systems. But if you're restricted to local measurements, even with many rounds of classical communication, it was shown way back in the late 90s that you can't discriminate these perfectly, and this is a very famous example. And it's useful to think of them as sitting, this is why they're called the domino states, as sitting in a grid like this, and you can kind of argue that any measurement you make on either side must cut at least one of the dominoes and make some states less distinguishable. so when you start thinking about these sorts of states enough, you see them everywhere, and this is from the Glasgow subway, from the seats on the subway. So this seemed like a good candidate to look at. So what we know is that you can't distinguish them perfectly locally. If we put this additional restriction that we're restricting even further the set of measurements that are allowed, how well can we do? So why are these states surprising? The standard sort of reason why people were interested in this are that they've got no entanglement, but nevertheless, joint measurements are necessary to distinguish between them. But back in 2013, some people at IQC showed that the bound on how well you can do is actually pretty small. By pretty small, I mean 10 to the minus 8. So, you know, you show me an experimentalist who can show that gap. So this is only a bound. It may be bigger than this, but it's known to be pretty small. And this is, yeah.
How many back and forth do you need for that kind of bound?
So this is asymptotic with lots of, yeah, lots of back and forth. Exactly. So with any fixed number of measurements, it's of course less than this, but you have to talk about when you stop. And so for what's now surprising to me about these states is that if you restricted just one round of classical communication, then these sort of simple local strategies actually do pretty badly. And so using this condition that I showed you, you can show that the optimal local adaptive scheme succeeds only with probability about 84%. So there's quite a big gap between what you can do with global measurements versus local adaptive. The other thing I would say is, how do you actually do that in practice? So these are my set of states. Note that these ones, for example, are perfectly distinguishable on B alone. So if I knew I just had one of these three, I could do a measurement on B, which perfectly distinguishes them. And indeed, there's 8 sets within there for which that's true. And if you stare at them long enough, you can convince yourself of that. And so a candidate strategy would be to use the measurement on the first system to try to determine to which of these distinguishable subsets your state belongs, and then use the measurement on the second system to perfectly distinguish within that subset. And indeed, you can show that that's the optimal strategy. And the probability of correctly determining the state, as I said, is 84%, which is the best we can do without a quantum number. So those cases for which we now know what the best kind of strategy is for these local adaptive measurements are always of this form. So the first measurement you use to separate your whole set of states into possible subsets, and the measurement on the other system you use to distinguish between those subsets. And so it gives, I think, a bit of insight on how you would approach these kinds of problems more generally.
I got confused. Before you gave this tiny number, now you're saying 84%. So what's the difference in the rules for you get?
Yeah, good. So this tiny number is if you allow lots of classical communication. So you measure...
You mean you repeat this process many times?
You measure system A kind of arbitrarily weakly. Has classical communication to B, measure that quite weakly, and so on. So with lots of rounds of communication. Yep.
And in B, you just make one measurement and a strong measurement.
So for this...
To get the 84%.
For this second one, you only allow one round of communication.
One round.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
So you said at the end of this, you said that this gives you some insight into what kind of schemes might be optimal more generally. So what did you mean by more general? What's the restriction here that you would relax?
So, I just mean for more general sets of states. So I have a bipartite problem with separable states over system A and system B. It turns out that those cases for which we know what the optimal local adaptive measurement is, it's always of this form. So there's only a couple, but it's of the form. Use the first measurement to try to eliminate some set or determine which subset your state belongs to, and the second to discriminate within that subset.
So that kind of strategy you just described is known to be optimal for this example?
For this example,
and for,
the double trine, so the one I referred to earlier. So the best measurement in that case is the anti-trine, so you use the first measurement to rule out one state, and the second one to distinguish optimally between the other two. And you can show that more general symmetric states, that strategy works well, I haven't proved that it's optimal, but it's quite close to what you can do with the best joint measurement, and so it's likely that it is optimal. Yep.
What does the 0 minus 1 in the kit mean?
Oh, sorry, what does this mean? Yeah, apologies, I should have said that. So anywhere there's something like this, it means the equal superposition. So this is 1/√2 0+1. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so that was the first case. The second case in which we have kind of new analytical techniques is for general minimum error discrimination problems for qubits. And what turns out to be important in these problems is this what's called the Lagrange operator. And this is just this combination of operators. And it's the trace of this which gives you the maximum probability of success, trace of this operator. And further, it's known to be unique for any set of states. So the optimal measurement may not be unique, but it's known that this operator is unique. Those of you who know anything about semi-definite programming, this is the thing that shows up when you define the dual of the problem. If not, don't worry about it. but in terms of this, we can write this necessary and sufficient condition I gave you earlier in this way. So it's just this Lagrange operator minus pj rho j should be a positive operator.
So here the operators appear in the optimal Hellstrom measurement.
In the optimal measurement.
And you said that was not unique. So you're saying for any choice of such pi is like the same gap. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So if it's not always unique, sometimes it is. So for simple cases like just two states, the optimal measurement is unique. The cases in which it's not unique usually means you've got a linearly dependent set. And there's some ambiguity in which is the best subset to identify. So there are cases in which this is not unique, but this combination is. Yep. Yeah.
In this gamma minus pj rho j positive, is that a bunch of conditions for each j, or is it?
Yes.
So it's several conditions.
Yeah. So this must hold for all j. That's right. And so there's a couple of, for the qubit case, there's a couple of quite nice geometric methods for taking this problem and finding what's the best way to measure a given set of states. One of them translates the problem to a problem of finding a minimal enclosing ball in the Bloch sphere, which is just a quite nice interpretation. And so if this is a representation of the states you want to discriminate between, there's a representation of this gamma operator which looks like this, which encloses all of these states. There's another geometric method which consists of defining what we call complementary states. So if this is a positive operator, I can call it something where this sigma j is a positive operator and rj is just a number. And you can show that in the Bloch sphere, the set of these forms a polytope which should be congruent to the polytope that the states form. So there's a bit of quite nice sort of interpretations of how to find optimal measurements. But you still have to do, given that geometric interpretation, there's still some solving to do. So what we were able to do was sort of complementary to this, come up with an algebraic approach, and that is the following. This gamma is enough to determine the probability of success via the trace, and also the optimal measurement. So you can show that this condition is also satisfied by the optimal measurement. And so once you find the operator gamma, you can plug in here, and then you just need to find an operator pi j, which is somehow orthogonal to this combination. If that's English or Croatian, so we're happy. And so it's completely enough to just determine this gamma matrix, and then you can find out everything. The key to our method, this sort of algebraic method, is that we can show, and it's not too hard to show, but I'm not going to bore you with the details, that if this is non-zero in the qubit case, and rho j is a pure state, then this condition holds. And this gives us a linear condition on gamma minus one, the inverse of this matrix. So these are all known. These are my states, Psi J and Pj are known. And so this gives me just a set of linear conditions, which I can invert to find gamma minus one and find gamma. And so given any set, I can construct these conditions and find the optimal measurement. A sketch of how this works is, so there's a little innocuous phrase in here which says, if pi j is non-zero, so how do you know that that particular operator should be non-zero? The answer is you don't, and so you have to do a search. And so a sketch of the method is you first check if what's called the no measurement solution is optimal, so that is there's only one non-zero operator pi j. If that's not the case, you check if the two outcome solution is optimal, and so on. But in each case, it's just a set of linear constraints that you can invert to find the optimal measurement. Okay, so what can we do with this? So we took our favorite set of states, which are the trine states. These are quite nice because they've got lots of symmetry, so it's sort of easy to work with. And they're also sort of the simplest case that goes beyond what's well known, which is just two states. And so with this technique, we can find the optimal measurement and probability of success for this Z states with symmetry with arbitrary priors. And although this may not sound so exciting, it's sort of funny that this kind of problem has been known since the 70s. And the only case for which we can solve for arbitrary priors is the two-state solution. I hate saying two-state solution, it sounds like a political thing. The problem of two quantum states. So that we can do with arbitrary priors. And so this is only the second such case for which we can actually map out the whole parameter space. Yeah.
So the difference between the, when you say Q, but you just mean that the local Hilbert space to measure is two.
Yeah.
Is that the only difference between this section and the previous task?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And some of these techniques generalize, but not obviously. So it works for qubits basically because we've got a nice block sphere representation. The generalization to mixed states is also possible. I didn't talk about it, but
it's
for qubits.
Many qubits, or is it just a single qubit?
Just a single qubit now, yeah.
When you say priors, is that the piece of I? Is that what you mean by the priors?
Yeah.
And also, in your scheme, is it guaranteed at each stage that this gamma will be invertible by?
Yes. So, good question. So this condition that this operator should be positive tells me that on the space spanned by rho j, by all the rho j's, that gamma must be full rank and therefore invertible. So what we learn from this that's a bit more general than any just specific solution is that actually for most of the parameter space, it's enough to do just a very simple two outcome measurement. So what is shown here is, so we've chosen P0 to be greater than or equal to P1, greater than or equal to P2 without loss of generality. And further, you can parameterize them by two parameters, P and delta. And for all parameter space, so for P versus delta, what we show here is the region for which you need just a two outcome measurement and the region for which you need a three outcome measurement. And all this light gray region here is where a two outcome measurement is enough. So why is that significant? Because it's just a basic von Neumann, simplest bog standard measurement that you can do. And here is where you need something just slightly more complicated, a POVM measurement. And further, we can write down analytical solutions for the optimal probability of success in those regions. This is what it looks like for the two-element measurement. So what I mean by that is it only ever gives the result that identifies state 0 or state 1, and never identifies the least likely state, state 2. And for the free element one, we get this slightly more complicated expression, but it's all nice and symmetric under exchange of 0, 1, and 2, as you might expect.
So the upper white region is redundant by symmetry?
This region here is excluded by this ordering. So this line here corresponds to P1 equals P2. Yeah. And this boundary here, it's not a very nice expression, but you can write it down analytically. It's a solution of a quadratic. And just to sort of also compare in some of this region, so for each of these values of p, here on the right-hand side is the probability of success for the 2 and 3 outcome measurements. In this region, it's where we know the 2-outcome measurement is optimal. So actually, this dotted line that shows the 3-outcome 1 gives us spurious results. It doesn't define an allowed measurement. So it's really past this line that both solutions are possible. And what we see from this is that even in this region where the 3-outcome measurement is optimal, it doesn't do very much better than the easiest simple von Neumann measurement. And so analogous to previously where I was talking about whether it's worth doing local adaptive, whether it's worth doing joint measurements versus local adaptive, here the message is when is it worth doing a POVM versus a von Neumann measurement? And it turns out that for a lot of the parameter space, a very simple basic projective measurement is good enough. Okay, good. So the last thing I want to talk about to bring those two pieces together is sequential measurement when you have imperfect detectors. So back when we were first talking about this scheme that I introduced at the start, a good candidate measurement to maybe try and do in practice was this 2 copies of the trine states that I introduced. But I already said that there's quite a small gap between what you can do with easier strategies versus what you can do with this joint strategy. And so is it worth doing experimentally? So further, the experimental system we were talking about at the time was an NV system with David Corey's group at IQC. And the detection efficiency at the time, it may be improved now, but the detection efficiency for a measurement was quite low. And so the idea is an NV center. You take a diamond, you take out 2 carbons. But I like to describe it like this. You don't literally do this, but it's an imperfection in diamond where 2 carbons are missing from the lattice, and there's a nitrogen and a vacancy in place of where those carbons would be. Surrounding this nitrogen vacancy, there are 2 kind of unpaired electrons that form a triplet space, and these can form a qutrit. So they're usually used as a qubit, the 0 versus the ±1 manifold. But that's the physical system, so spin states in a nitrogen vacancy system. And how you measure these things is by fluorescence, basically. So you pump the 0 state to a higher level, and it's the if your system is in the 1 state, it goes to the higher level. And then via fluorescence, you can measure the readout. But the collection efficiency is not very good, so the detection efficiency is very low. So this could be a good thing or a bad thing. if your detection efficiency is very low, does this give maybe an additional advantage for joint schemes? My intuition, which, spoiler, was completely wrong, was that if your detection efficiency is quite low, then you really want to optimize what each click is telling you, because you don't get them very often. And so my sort of intuition was that it's somehow more important to kind of fully optimize the information you get for those cases when the detector does fire. Does this then give an increased advantage for joint measurement? Because obviously for the adaptive case, you need to see 2 clicks. Okay. So just to kind of formulate how you would figure out an answer to that, you can imagine that on the first copy, you do, so I have these 2 copy states. Each of them are prepared, each of the systems are prepared identically. I do some measurement on the first copy, which has some probability of success and some probability of failure. If the measurement fails, then I get no new information, but I can still measure my second system. So I can still make a measurement on the second system, and that has some probability of success and some probability of failure. If this succeeds, then I do get to update my information and make some measurement of my second system. And overall, the probability of successfully getting the right information out of all this scheme is given by the combination of all of these possible outcomes of the tree. And the point to note is that there's a trade-off here between how I choose this first measurement so that I get some information in the cases when the second measurement fails, but I also want to somehow optimize the information I get when both measurements are successful. And so there's this kind of more complicated optimization problem. So now that we have finally this analytical solution for arbitrary priors for the triangles, actually this makes this a little bit easier. So what we can say is that whatever this optimal strategy is for arbitrary detector efficiency, it should respect the symmetry of the states. And so the first thing we can say is that the first measurement, if it has some POVM element along some direction with an angle phi to state psi zero, then it also must have one with the same angle to psi one and the same angle to psi two. So I can restrict the possible set of outcome of measurements I need to think about. And then I can parameterize everything in terms of phi. I can do some updating of priors and plug in my analytical solution for the optimal measurement and just kind of turn the wheel. So what we find is the following. So let me talk you through it. There's a black line underneath all this, which it's good that you can't see it, which shows the optimal sequential measurement for arbitrary detector efficiency. So here on the x-axis is the detector efficiency, and this is my probability of correctly determining the state. For the black line underneath all this, that's the optimal measurement that we derive through this whole procedure. These other lines show particular strategies for particular values of that phi, and what this tells us is that actually it's not that sensitive to exactly how well we do that first measurement. So this orange line corresponds to phi equals zero, which means my first measurement is along the triangle states. The purple one, pi over six, and the blue one, pi over three. And so for all regions of parameter space, this optimal measurement is quite well approximated by one of those three. Yeah.
Farah, when you're saying a measurement, do you mean that I'm repeating measuring in some basis however many times it takes to converge to the true probability of the outcome there and then moving on to the next order?
Sorry, I didn't catch the start of.
So like if I measure a qubit in some basis, I'm going to get, you know, plus and minus one with some probability, right?
Yeah.
And I repeat them in the same basis. I would have to do that like many times to converge to the actual probability. So when you say a measurement, are you saying many measurements repeated to converge to that, or is it just one?
So, I mean, the assumption is always it's a single shot. So you're given a copy of the system or systems, but you want to optimize your probability.
Yes,
so now if you're going to actually measure this experimentally, yes, you would do it lots of times to actually measure the probability. Yep.
Oh, so that would be the same results pulled in this if I were allowed to measure arbitrary numbers of times.
So if you can measure arbitrary number of times, then again, you should talk about whether you should adapt for subsequent measurements. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Good, and so finally, this is the, after all that work, the optimal sequential strategy, and how does it compare to the optimal joint with detector inefficiencies? Bad news is that the gap gets even smaller. So this black line is the joint measurement with the most simplest assumptions possible, which is that the inefficiency associated with the joint measurement is the same as associated with each of these sequential measurements. And so it's just scaled by some probability eta. So the gap gets even smaller as the detector efficiency gets bad. Of course, it's maybe not so surprising when you think about it. This is not the same effect as entanglement being fragile to loss. What's going on here is that if you do a local adaptive strategy, you have two chances of getting information. So in this tree back here, if this first measurement fails on the first copy, you still have a chance to measure the second copy and get some information out. Whereas for the joint strategy, the assumption is you're trying to get everything at once. And so sometimes it just fails and you don't get anything. And so there's actually even a tiny region with very poor detector efficiency for which just doing something simple, local adaptive measurement, is better than doing a joint measurement.
But yeah. I guess the fair comparison would be with two joint measurements that are also adaptive, right? Because then you'd have two states.
So you have one copy of the joint state.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood.
And so in each case, so either you measure the two copies jointly, or you measure one feed forward and then measure the other.
Okay.
So in each case, your two copies are gone once you've measured.
Does that mean the joint measurement cannot actually mimic this adaptive, local adaptive measurement? Because you said in some cases the local adaptive measurement does better than the joint measurement.
Yeah.
So there's no form of joint measurement that can mimic the local adaptive.
Right, so what you could ask is, so for example, if you wanted to do a bell basis measurement, how you might do that in practice would be to do a unitary from the bell basis to a product basis, and then measure the product basis locally in each system. And then even when you don't get all the information out, you still get some out, because you might get a 0-1 measurement from one system but not the other, for example. So you can think of other ways in which you might actually perform the joint measurement in principle, in practice. As I said, what we did here was just assume the simplest thing, which is I do one joint measurement which has the same probability of succeeding, the same detector inefficiency as I was assuming for the separate measurements. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure. The one joint measurement, does it have to be a projective measurement, or it can be?
It doesn't have to be, but it is in this case.
That's the best one.
Yeah.
It just seems counterintuitive that so joint measurement is such a general concept. It seems counterintuitive that it does not embrace also what you can do with this local adaptive measurement.
Right. So the answer is it does. So if you allow all joint measurements, then of course you're also allowing adaptive measurement. But the way in which the loss enters is different. So the joint measurement, you either succeed or you fail. The local adaptive measurement is in two steps. So you might fail on one of the steps, but you still have a chance of getting some information in the second step.
It has something to do with the inefficiency of the detector.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you could have joint measurements where you put the answer that you're going to measure in one qubit, and then
yes.
not to another qubit.
Exactly.
You measure those separately, and then
yeah.
it becomes better again.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, they use this sort of technique to improve efficiency of readout, of course. Yeah. Okay. Good. So, in conclusion. It's pretty hard, it turns out, to find kind of quite simple measurement problems for which having joint control is significantly better than doing something much simpler. I talked about a couple of analytical techniques, one for sequential measurements. And the more general thing I said to kind of draw out of that is not just that particular case, but in general, it seems that the best strategy for these kind of local adaptive schemes is this subset discrimination idea. The qubit state discrimination example, again, the kind of more general thing to take out is that for most of the parameter space, the best thing to do is the simplest possible, so just some projective measurement. And with imperfect detector efficiencies, the advantage of joint measurements over these simpler schemes is decreased even more, which was actually surprising to me at the time, but in hindsight, it's maybe not so surprising. And so sometimes just the simplest procedure you can do is good enough. That's it. Thank you.
Questions? The loss function, not the loss function, the condition you wrote down, it jointly involved the state and the measurement set, right? So
Yes.
If you didn't know anything about the state, suppose you're trying to learn about the state and like in a way of measuring it at the same time.
Yes.
Would there be a way of manipulating that into like a... Like,
you mean this one?
Yes. So you said before that could be manipulated into like a... What am I saying here? I think like a loss function or something that measures how good a particular P and rho is rather than just saying that it's the best. Is that possible to put?
Sure. So the thing we're optimizing is this thing.
Okay.
So the trace over this combination.
Okay, so that you could use that as like an error function on how.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is just the joint probability, the sum over the joint probabilities that J was prepared and that my measurement told me J was prepared.
So if you're trying to do some kind of general tomography task, you would need to change pi and rho, like your belief about pi and rho. Like in some kind of joint, like right there.
So for a more general tomography task, it doesn't fit easily in this kind of framework. So what's assumed here is that you know what the states are, what the possible states are.
States,
yes,
right?
Okay. Exactly.
You could expand that to be all states?
You could. Yeah, you can expand that to be all states, and then you have a continuous distribution over states. Sure, and you can update, and then you can update your priors post measurement.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you can that would be the appropriate quantity. That would be the one.
This one here.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
But it's a bit misleading in the continuous case because this is a probability of correctly determining the state. It's a little bit misleading in the continuous case because you'll never get it exactly. So what's better is some notion of how far is your estimate from the actual state. And that's what's typically used in tomography.
So question, the paradigm you're describing at the beginning, how do people normally think about physically implementing joint measurements? Because you know, on the one hand, you could see it as I just have quantum channels among the parties, and I say accumulate all the systems in one party's lab and do the joint measurement there. Or I could say, you know, they share entanglement, and those quantum channels are just achieved by teleporting. And it seems to me that you could think of this adaptive strategy as a case where it's like the teleportation case, but you don't have the advantage of the entanglement. So what I'm saying is, if the optimal joint measurement could be proven to you don't need to teleport all the information about system A, but maybe something less. In fact, to do the optimal case, you could get away with very little entanglement.
Right.
Then perhaps that's a reason for thinking that the local adaptive strategy, which has no entanglement, will achieve
will sort of do okay.
Performance. So are those intuitions of mine completely off base, or is there something?
So you probably could show. The difficulty is it's quite hard to show how much entanglement you need to perform a particular measurement. So I would agree with the intuition that if you can show that not much entanglement is needed, then probably the local strategies would do pretty well. Probably the right intuition, but.
Is there some experimental situation that people actually have in mind where this kind of problem comes up, where a finite number of states are prepared with known problems?
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's usually coached in a communication scenario. So suppose you're using a quantum channel to communicate. You can also apply to sort of metrology. Algorithms usually have some set of possible outcomes, and so what's the best way to measure your output? Of course, usually for algorithms, the end result is the different possible outcomes are almost orthogonal, so actually it doesn't matter too much what you measure. But they're the sorts of situations.
You don't know the a priori probabilities of the outcomes.
Sure. So you might not, yeah.
So how much does it depend on knowing the a priori probabilities?
So it changes a lot for different prior probabilities. Yeah, the best measurement to do and the success strategy, yeah.
That's not a comment. It might be obscure to some people who haven't heard some talk that I gave, which might have been obscure. But I mean, there is a situation where you really need joint measurements, which is where you're trying to detect or measure what I would call events. So it's
right.
The case I was referring to before, say the same system at successive times. If you're trying to measure what I would call events of that system that are temporally extended, or you might say distributed in time, the event, you know, the definition of the event cannot be done by a sequence of just behaviors at successive times, but it's more complicated. Then you really need this joint kind of thing. So I wonder, it's probably, I'm not sure it'll be clear to see what I'm saying, but I wonder whether your techniques would help to design optimal
okay.
strategies for measuring temporally extended events.
So then what do you mean by a joint measurement over a system at different times?
Well, I mean,
times?
Accumulating information in this was a quantum number, I guess.
Okay.
A quantum number.
Okay.
Doing some
so a sort of continuous interaction.
The system that we met, you know, that holds the memory.
Right, okay.
Some ancillary. Typically ancillaries. So if you want
perhaps. To... Yeah. Sorry.
If you want a very simple example of an event that's temporally extended, you might consider a pair of two slits, you know, two masks, each with two slits or something. And you want to know whether the trajectory that the particle follows either is an X-like, belongs to one of these two that makes an X. It either goes through the upper slit and the lower slit and then goes to some detector, or goes through the lower slit and then the upper slit and goes to some other detector.
Okay.
But you want to distinguish that event or that set of histories from the complement, where it goes either through both the upper slits or both the lower slits.
You don't want to know which one.
And you don't want to know which one. That's right. You want to determine just that information.
So I can imagine that you could do some kind of control knot after the first,
yeah,
and then another one after the second.
Control knot for the first control knot.
And it somehow...
Second, and then couple them together in some way.
Right.
It's kind of a different class of questions, I think, than
people
often consider.
Yeah.
Which is motivated by things where space-time is important, not just space at a moment of time. So,
sure.
Like, of course, quantum gravity being the ultimate example
of
this, where all observables are, in some sense, global in nature. All covariant, you know, diffeomorphism invariant models.
So, I mean, I can imagine for the kind of case you described that if you make some kind of measurement in the middle, you're really destroying everything, and then people would,
So I think, personally, if you talk when you're asked a question, I think by Raphael, whether it applies to sequences, that it could be the same system. You said, yes, it could be the same system, which I've reinitialed.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, that's, you know, the same system, but it's been, you know, prepared in the original state over again.
Oh, yeah,
where's
the problem?
You're considering
something different.
Evolving.
Sure.
And it really doesn't fit in the paradigm here, I think.
Sure. I mean, you can define this probe to not extract everything if you want it to be minimally disturbing somehow. It's not what we did, but you could. Which might be more applicable.
But of course, in this case, it's a little hard to compare fairly to sequential measurements because the interaction is also changing what's happening.
That's right. So,
yeah.
So
we don't talk about disturbance.
Two strategies.
Yeah.
There'd be only one strategy, but there'd be different variations on it. I mean, which set of ancillaries do you use?
Right.
How do you couple them to each other? So how many do you need, pencils do you need? Because I mean, someone wants, I mean, in fact, Urvashi wants to do this experiment. It's a question, how do you actually create the necessary couplings and so on in an optics web, in her case,
okay.
An optics web.
Yeah.
You were talking about two measurements and one of them was conditional and you were talking about necessary information conditions and the editor.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious why you have to relax the non-conditional.
Why this is still arbitrary?
Yeah.
There may be something better, but this was the best I could do. So basically using the same sorts of techniques that we would use to prove necessity here, which is you take a variation of this measurement. So if this is an optimal measurement, then if I vary it slightly, it should be a stationary point, and so it shouldn't change. I can do something similar with the joint measurement, two-step measurement. But it just turns out that the kind of natural conclusion of that still leaves this arbitrary measurement on system B here. I can show you more details kind of offline, but I tried to do something different, but that's the best I could get.
It's curious that there's asymmetry there.
So the asymmetry is almost built in because you state which system you measure first. So. Yeah, so there is an asymmetry. Hey, Debbie.
I don't think I'm mistaken understanding the question here because I gave you the apology for that.
What happened in the match in the end?
Huh?
Did you come from the match?
Yes.
What happened?
The speakers always have the country losing. Three out of three, the last 2 weeks.
No, but what was the score? How did the match end?
2-1.
Okay. Two? Two?
England lost.
England lost.
Oh.
Okay.
No, I really think that it's important not to speak when your country is playing. There's some interest about this question. So let me double check that I get it correctly. That you have these tri-states, you draw one out of the three things and you give the person two copies to this thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the claim is that the adaptive strategy is not so much worse than the joint strategy.
It's not so much worse. Yes. Yeah.
Now, I wonder if you have the tri-state, you draw one out of the three.
Yeah.
But instead of two copies of the same state, you give one copy of the state and one state and a holder to it. Do you know this? What are the conclusions?
Yeah, so that turns out to be the same. So it's a good question. So the reason it's the same is that there's a local unitary that transforms the antitrine to the trine. If you take the tetrad state, so four states with symmetry, then there's no longer a CP map that transforms one set to the other. And then there's a big gap between what you can do with two copies of the tetrad versus one tetrad and one anti.
Nice to know, because...
But not for trine.
In this case, there is, again, no entanglement between the two copies.
Yeah.
But there is some very interesting correlation, right?
So, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
The
so just a rotation. So they're all in the same equator of the Bloch sphere, right? So I don't have enough hands, but basically you just rotate about the z-axis, and you can rotate one set into the other. But as soon as you use more than one equatorial plane, then you can't do that anymore because it corresponds to a universal knot, which isn't allowed. Yeah, good question. I like that.
Well, let's thank Sarah.